I was almost perfect. It was almost perfect, Scott Lowe. I might have an issue. There could be an issue with my timing and my coordination. I'm not sure if Lauren Haywood has gotten the right URL to link to this video.
Did I lock her out? Anyway, should be open in room. I am Jim Groom. This is DS106 Radio. Thank you, Scott Lowe, for spinning a half an hour of grocery store music. I cracked myself up. I really actually enjoyed it. It's hard to explain to the untrained ear how beautiful it is to come up into my office and hear the Scott Lowe soundscape work in the room. It's an experience to behold, and I almost feel spoiled that it's only me for the last half hour. Because Scott Lowe's, you know, pang of, is anyone listening? Does it matter? Is always real on DS106 Radio. It's part of the existential angst that makes it interesting. But someone's always kind of listening. And it doesn't get much more intimate than DS106 Radio, for better or for worse. So there is that. So anyway, thank you, Scott Lowe. Now, on to Utopian Tendencies. I think this is our sixth or seventh episode, which is hard to imagine. We're going to be talking about lifelong learning today. And I think what I'm just doing right now is I'm killing a little time until I figure out whether I gave my co-host the correct link. Ah, you went to this exact URL. Oh, maybe I'm at the wrong one. Okay. Yeah, give me a second. I'm gonna bring Lauren here because she's right, I'm wrong. Lauren, go to /cloud. I got confused from my last discussion. So Lauren's coming in here a second. I'm not confused. I was wrong. I mean, I'm not surprised. I was wrong. She was right. And we are going to, I think, come together here in a second. But let me set it up while Lauren's jumping in. Last week we talked about Web 2.0. And it was fun. I still have to blog it. I will. But it was kind of a reflection back on Tim O'Reilly's famous essay. And we talked about Web 2.0 as kind of a moment and a movement. And the thing about it is it wasn't as good as Lauren's essays usually are. So this week we're getting back on track, so to speak. And Lauren just entered the room. Elvis has entered the building.
Hello, I found you.
You found me. Yes, it was my fault. I took full responsibility publicly.
Okay.
I got confused with my earlier discussion. I did /cloud, thinking I was doing Utopia. You get the idea. Cloud is Utopia. That could be a whole nother discussion. But I was just setting up the discussion, whereas Web 2.0 was last week, and you provided another, I think, just compelling essay by, let me make sure I get this right, Annette Krauss.
Yeah, Annette Krauss.
And the essay is titled Lifelong Learning and the Professionalized Learner. And as a quick joke, I was plugging the show when I was talking with Lauren and Tim. And at the end of the show, I was asking Scott Lowe to hold down the radio, which he did beautifully. And I was like, yeah, we're going to be talking about, and I forgot lifelong learning as a term.
And Tim was like, you really prepared for this one. But I did. I did. So lifelong learning. So I'll let you introduce the essay, and then we can just start chatting away. I have a lot to say as usual, so I'll try and shut up and listen.
Just no, shut fine. Up and I'm, listen. I'm happy with you chatting away. Okay. So yeah, Lifelong Learning and the Professionalized Learner by Annette Krauss, which I've linked out under the hashtag if people want to access it at some point if you haven't already seen, is from a book called Unlearning Exercises: Are Organizations as Sites of Unlearning? So the book includes lots of different essays by different people, including other kind of descriptions of work that Annette Krauss has done as well. But this is a long form text where she kind of digs into basically critiquing European policies related to lifelong learning, where the term originates and their impacts on the perceived role of education and arts organisations where we are now. So the book itself is kind of looking a lot at art organisations, but as like Annette Krauss is both an arts practitioner, an academic, and you know, works closely with both education, academia, and arts organisations, she kind of talks about it from different perspectives. And she, through this text, she kind of charts the political agenda of lifelong learning policies with, like, alongside neoliberal strategies. So from like the 2000s or literally 2000 when the first papers start coming out, and how the kind of vocabulary and the kind of ideology around it has kind of grown since then. So when we're talking about neoliberal strategies, we're talking about like deregulation as a form of governance, and converting kind of non-economic kind of subjects and things in the world to economic ones. So yeah, hopefully that sets up a bit.
It does. It sets it up beautifully. And I think one of the things that really struck me, and I had no idea, like, what I thought was interesting about the essay, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, was how she traces, almost like Foucault's archaeologies, like he does archaeology of text to look at the evolving signification of certain terms. She does that really beautifully for this notion of lifelong learning, and really links it to this 2000 European Union memorandum called the Lisbon Memorandum for Lifelong Learning from 2000. And it's crazy because here's a quote right from the paper, and I'll just read a bit because it really gets into it. Lifelong learning is a dominant discourse engendered through education. I don't think I have the right intonation. I don't think she's really reading it like that. She's probably a little bit more like, you could feel it seething. Lifelong learning. Whenever you hear the term, it's like, ugh. Lifelong learning is a dominant discourse engendered through education policy in the last decades. A general description can be derived from the Lisbon Memorandum for Lifelong Learning, and here's the general description. All learning as a seamless continuum from cradle to grave. And I just stopped right there at that quote, and I'm like, what are we in for in this essay? Because this comes like second paragraph. And she sets up beautifully in my mind what you think is a relatively toothless, you know what, somewhat kind of like, you know, neutral term. Lifelong learning. Like, hey, it's not a bad thing. I go on YouTube. I learn how to fix my plumbing. I go on a blog. I learn about, you know, the Spanish Revolution. Everything's good, right? What's wrong with lifelong learning? And then she really starts to build in the way in which the European Union and the Europe in general is where she focuses her attention, is really using this as a means to reframe the economy of education, right? Well, I mean, quite directly.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a transition from basically moving towards a knowledge economy kind of thing. So, and she talks about their impacts in, I suppose, countries like the UK, where higher education in particular is heavily marketized in the same way that in the US it is, and universities relying on getting international students in and things like that to because they were very reliant on the fees and stuff like that compared to other European countries, say Germany and things like that, that aren't as reliant on that kind of the market force of bringing in new students and kind of claiming fees and things like that. But to a greater or lesser extent, that how this vocabulary and these ideas kind of impact policy throughout Europe.
I tell you what struck me as I'm looking and thinking and watching what's happening, and my dog's gonna bark because the bell rang. It happens. It's a life. You know what? It's his life right now. Okay, life is intervening. But 1972, the UNESCO report, Learning to Be. So I love that she even frames almost like a 40, 50 year frame for this emergence of the importance of lifelong learning, the knowledge economy, deregulation of that economy as a means to basically marketize every single element of it, right? The thing that's interesting is we are living currently within the kind of, you know, the logical extension of that drive for 50 years and the absolute chaos it has, you know, in many ways engendered on our discipline, on our, like, what would we call it, the industry of education, if you will. And it's really interesting to read through some of that as you're reading this paper from 2016 2018. I think it's 16, but I might be wrong.
2018.
It really is kind of prophetic and talking about the implications of deregulation and what that means for our moment. It's wild.
She also talks about, like, she draws on the work of, like, Freire and Hooks and people like that, and kind of going back to, you know, what originally was intended as kind of almost, you know, well, literally as an emancipatory kind of education, and why everyone should be brought in to be able to access education, and what that should mean for individuals, and to, you know, in terms of freedom or agency and stuff like that, and kind of how some of that language has been warped and co-opted towards a kind of neoliberal understanding of that you as an individual are responsible for your value and economic worth and in terms of human capital, and how some of it has a call or kind of refers to works that are kind of trying to look at the links between capitalism and colonialism, and then how neoliberal strategies continue that kind of thought into this, like, new idea of human capital and everyone having to be measured and be considered as a subject within like market forces and stuff like that. So she's trying to disentangle some of that language as well, kind of thing, and that, and saying this, these notions of lifelong learning aren't that kind of emancipatory idea of education and what it could be, kind of thing. It is this systematized idea of that you move a child through education, continually reskill them so that they exist as valuable human capital until the end of their life. And it's a personal failure if they aren't able to maintain themselves as skilled in the need, you know, to meet the needs of market forces or whatever.
And that term skill is a really, is an interesting one. I want to talk about that. But before we do, I haven't read political scientist Wendy Brown, but she's someone who I really want to read now, because she quotes her to great effect in about the second or third page in the essay. She talks in a section called How Not to Be Governed at Such Costs. And there's a great quote from Wendy Brown. I'll read it now. When she talks about the liberalization and deregulation of the market and its primary means of governance, etc., political scientist Wendy Brown terms this the conversion of non-economic domains, activities, and subjects into economic ones. Neoliberalism construes subjects as market actors everywhere. And most importantly, as an advanced form of capitalism, neoliberalism is a logical unfolding of the historical conditions of empire that made the university possible. So, like, not only going back 50 years, but going back to the long imperial kind of project of the university, and you find it coming to an almost a bit of a head in this essay with, you know, the question of who's paying for it,
you know, how are we understanding who gets access to it, and then what are the historical conditions that led us not only to having it, but to where we are now. I mean, it's a really, I love how all the essays you've shared have been really readable and have not gotten too deep into the jargon, but have gotten really, have really kind of broken down what I assume, like I said, is a fairly, you know, uncomplicated, not very political term like lifelong learning, and shows a whole kind of methodology of building a new frame around it. It's really, I love that about it.
I think originally when I sent you the text, I was saying I had a bit of an anxiety about the term of lifelong learning, because I'd used it myself kind of thing, and I'd seen other people use it. And I thought it was good, like this idea that everyone should be able to access, and it has, like, you know, it sounds like it relates to kind of principles of open education and all those kind of things, or critical pedagogy. But then I realised that a lot of people that I hear use it, actually, they're talking about disadvantaged people being able to access education, or other communities or ages of people accessing education. But then kind of realising that they're talking about those people as kind of almost, that their capital to be gained by increasing fees, like just that you can ask them to pay more fees, or they get them to kind of take out more loans and things like that, to kind of get them to buy into the system, that they're only valuable if they get whatever level of education or a degree or whatever else. And actually, and like this idea of selling them, this idea of that they'll become more employable, that they can transition to a better paid job or get work at all. Because in the UK in particular, it's really hard to get anything other than minimum wage without any form of degree. And even when you get a degree, it could still be minimum wage or only slightly above, kind of thing. So this is massive. Young people are massively impacted by the necessity to have, you know, an honours degree or whatever else. You know, like a creep feeling, like I wasn't sure what was wrong with it, but I could see that something was wrong with it, kind of thing. It's just like the rhetoric that kind of formed around it. But again, like we've talked about before, people using the term open as if it's like the same as good, kind of thing. Like, so open source, open licensing or whatever, somehow that it allows goodness to take effect or whatever. That this lifelong learning idea meant that something good was happening. And then I could see that it wasn't, because actually the people that are using the term didn't feel any empathy for the people that they were claiming would benefit from, you know, the activities of lifelong learning or whatever else, kind of thing. And then when I just kind of bought this book on a whim, someone told me about the publisher, and the communism book that I used for our OER 20 presentation thing as well, it's from the same publisher. And I got a couple of books like that that I thought, oh, they sound like they're a good gateway into some things, and they turned out to be. And I originally was interested in the role of arts organisations in alternative education, but then this essay was like, wait a second. This is all the reasons why this like creeping kind of like anxiety or whatever to do with lifelong learning is there.
And it's really like, I would take a course from you on this, because whether you realize it or not, you're putting together a really compelling series of readings about deconstructing some of our approaches to the tech and to education. And I'm appreciating it. It's an education for me. Like, for example, the skills point you made. So much of what we're talking about, right? I think, who says it? It's on, someone names it from the essay, and I'll find out who. Skills, the chimera, she calls it the chimera of modern education. Once defined from manual labor, now grafted onto intellectual labor in order to quantify and control the process. And how do you do that? With data, analytics. The idea that this job and this knowledge gets you, or this knowledge gets you this job, and the one-to-one skills gap, quote unquote. But it's interesting, because it was even, for me, a kind of like revelation in my own stupid stuff I do on a daily basis, like The Sopranos. I've been watching The Sopranos now for months, and I've told you about my little project about technology in The Sopranos. So episode 17 of season 6, there's a scene
where Tony Soprano is like depressed because AJ, his son, won't go to college or failed out of college. And one of the capos or one of the captains who works for Tony Soprano, who's a mobster, his son is going to Rutgers, which is a state school. And Tony's oldest daughter, Meadow, is going to Columbia. So there's the whole state versus Ivy going on, just to give you some context in the U.S. Anyway, all the mobsters complain about paying for college for their kids, yet they all do it. Yet they're pissed because it's both status, it's an idea of them not being part of the lifestyle, all this, or white collar crime as a better alternative to, you know, blue collar crime. But the other idea there is that one of Tony Soprano's captains, Patsy Parisi, says to Tony, you know what, at first I didn't want my kid to go to college, but then he went and he's starting to do sports gambling and he's making a fortune off these kids, so I want him to stay till he gets his PhD, which is kind of the joke, right? But after that he says, but you know what, he's learning stuff. Like, he says the shit he knows about computers, the kid built a website for his mom's ceramic company. And I'm thinking to myself, like, oh wait, that was like me in 2007, showing kids how to run a WordPress website. Like, I felt completely implicated in the skills question around the web, which links back to our Web 2.0 discussion last week. And it was just a really interesting kind of crossroads, because that's also what this essay is about. The way in which, not saying it so much, but yes, in so many words, the framework around technology as the kind of market container to build the whole idea of lifelong learning as a product that's constantly saleable. It was really, really, I don't know, it was a kind of, like I often have with these discussions, like, Jesus, I'm such a failure, or I'm such a sellout, or what was I doing really? Like, you know, because there is that piece in The Sopranos where I was like, I was the ed tech showing these kids how to make websites. Not that I think it's bad, I don't. But like, there's a complicated sense of people want to know what they're paying for, right? Like, there is that sense of what Tressie Cotton McMillan said the other day. This is what happens when you transform a student to a consumer. There's expectations around a tuition, and it changes the whole relationship of the academy. And I think that's quite powerful.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where to go. Yeah, I still don't get your, well, I get it in that everyone has their own like existential crisis about how they, well, some people don't, some people just don't care. They just barrel through and they go from paycheck to paycheck, and if they get a bigger paycheck, then they just don't care. So it's kind of, you know, maybe you should reflect on the fact that you're actually willing to try and work out if you're the bad guy or something like that. But I don't know, you're not, like, I don't understand really why you think you're the bad guy or whatever.
Well, because, I mean, I'm joking. Like, I'm not really feel like I'm,
yeah, yeah,
I'm the devil. But, like, I think, like, all of these things, like with Web 2.0, that we felt like lifelong learning was, like, a kind of unquestioned good, right? Like this is a possibility. Like, I don't think I was alone. I think the whole field, to some degree, was enamored with the possibilities. And it's kind of coming out the other side of it and looking at the broader vision that's being framed as early as 1972, but definitely 2000, that lifelong learning is a market move to deregulate. Like, that's a context I wasn't thinking about in 2007, but was real. You know what I mean? When I was using that term that everyone was using. They do mention utopia in the essay.
They do. I'm trying to. I brought the physical book with me because I thought that might be easy to flick through, and then I'm still going to my PDF copy or whatever flicking through.
The PDF copy was awesome, though. Thank you.
It was the best I could do with that. I've thankfully got a home like scanner printer deal. So me trying to smush the book that's like a little bit wide into an A4 scanner, you know, you get what you get.
So here's the. But, Tell me what you think about the reference to the utopian. This comes later on. And I always look for that when we're doing these discussions, obviously. But where is it? Let me find it. Oh, yeah. It's about art. Yeah. It's on page 93.
Okay, cool.
And it's when they talk more broadly about, you know, there's a lot of discussions about the neoliberal logic can be thwarted, no freedom, autonomy, etc. And then it says, as the feminist movement reminds us, the separation between artistic critique and social critique is furthermore based on a problematic understanding of autonomy as a practice that is always already infused and grounded in reproduction and maintenance, yet structurally invisibilized in order to keep its relationship to capital. The modern stakes for the autonomy of art had to do with severing itself from productive labor, conceivably to counter a world where the mental and manual labor brutalized some and idealized other. This basis for the form of autonomy has been the unfulfilled utopia of avant-garde as unalienated labor, while the labor of maintenance and reproductive work has remained alienated and invisible, which is super interesting, right?
There's a... So my existential crisis thing with like coming from an art background, so I made that choice to like, that was, art was not the thing that I was good at school. That was like a really random choice for me to go off and do. And then like, I was good at maths at school and I was told to go and get a maths degree and become an accountant. And I was like, I do not want to do that. Like, I couldn't imagine that as being a life that I'd want to pursue. And then I think with like understanding who gets to be successful in the art world, obviously there's a massive thing of like, I don't know, something like 99% of curators are white men kind of thing. It's like just race and gender issues are like to the extreme in the art world kind of thing. But also things like, that idea of you have to kind of perform this idea that you're almost like it's, I don't know, like the old kind of philosopher thing that you could like wander around and not, you know, people would just give you food, or you could live at people's houses and people would look after you because you're like, you have that performative role in society kind of thing. But as an artist, you kind of get to kind of detach yourself from the kind of like the gritty kind of labor that people have to perform, or whatever the societal duties, that you're there to kind of perform this other kind of role for society, and how stupid that is, like in reality that only some people are able to actually do that kind of thing. But also Annette Krauss does, she and other people do, they have this activity that they run at Casco Arts, which is where a lot of the different texts and kind of activities in the and learning exercises book comes from. They have this thing called toilet tissues, but the T with the brackets around it, so it's toilet issues. And it's how they discuss within the arts organisation productive and reproductive labour. So productive labour being, you know, produce something that is seen to be, you know, a market commodity. And then reproductive labour, like being whatever work that needs to be performed around that to keep the systems going, or that kind of structure going. So they ask the question in the arts organisation, who buys the toilet paper, as a way of kind of making visible the invisible labour that has to go on. Because there's not a role within the arts organisation, especially small arts organisations. You might not have technically a cleaner or whatever, it might just be the person that goes, things look a bit grimy, or we need to look after things, so we'll do it. So they start having conversations about who manages files and cleans files and runs updates on the office computers or whatever, or who is buying the toilet paper, or who cleans up after events, or who buys in whatever, to kind of show up who has to perform that labour. And there's other interesting things within this where they talk to groups of cleaners at different museums and galleries, this is in particularly in the Netherlands, and a lot of those cleaners turn out to be people that are undocumented migrants that might not be able to access bank cards and things like that. So they talk about the impact of cashless societies and all sorts of different things. So the book goes off in all sorts of different ways about ideas of alienated and alienated labour. But just that idea, asking the question, who buys your toilet paper in an office environment or in a small organisation, to show up, who feels that they have to perform that labour, or who feels that they would never have to think about it or never question where their toilet paper comes from. It's kind of a humorous take on kind of showing up that kind of thing.
And all the privilege that comes with the idea of being on the avant-garde, right? Like the utopia of erasing all of that labor and all of that struggle to kind of frame that. I remember in 2006, 2007, I was attending a conference, a museum conference, one of my first web conferences to understand like websites and museums. And one of the curators from the Museum of Contemporary Art was there. And I happened to be talking with him. It was small enough that we could chat. And one of the things he said, it's kind of a joke, like, to pretend like you can just be an artist in this world, given that most of the artists work the way they work right now after the Warhol factory moment. Is it's like $1 million, multi-million-dollar industry of labor, of other people doing the work to visualize and realize the artist's vision. You know, it's like a contracting firm versus an architect. And it was really, I don't know that much about the art world, I'm not an artist, but it was really eye-opening versus like the pop-up, you know, UMW console living room that costs $500 and, you know, a bunch of people come out and do it. And it's like, feels real. And someone on, why am I forgetting his name? He's like the original ed tech. He's a hippie. Howard Rheingold was recently saying on Twitter that he's creating a mini pop-up museum of just like work he does. He does this crazy hippie art. He sends it out. It's kind of cool and psychedelic, but like, he's just going to create a pop-up. And he's like, I hope other people start like doing. And I was like, that's kind of what UMW Console was. It was like a pop-up. We had no like permission. Like, there was no money involved. No one was charged for anything. It was donated. And there was a moment where you were reflecting on something in a weird, different kind of context outside of the market of art. You know what I mean? At least for a moment.
Yeah, you're right about the whole studio culture kind of thing, where any big named artist, they have 20 to 200 people working under them kind of thing, that they have loads of studio hands, which is back in the Renaissance times, that's how painters worked, like probably on a small scale actually, that you'd have however many apprentices. But now, like, all of those big name artists, they have lots of different people working on them, literally like Damien Hirst or whoever else. They literally just have a factory where there's loads of different people that have just paid, you know, not much money at all, like, I don't know, say $25,000 or whatever to sit and just paint dot paintings. So it's fine for a salary, but he's not the person that makes those dot paintings. He just signs them off kind of thing. But they're just, and he's still seen as part of the art world, but and if anyone else tried to do that, that would be seen as commercial art, or, you know, if you didn't have a degree, they call it outsider art kind of thing, you know, like if it's you handcrafting them. If it's just a kind of decorative object that you put on the wall kind of thing, if it doesn't have a signified meaning behind it, or you don't get any other value from it other than it just being worth a lot of money and, you know, it's an investment, it wouldn't be considered part of the art world. But because he's come up through the YBA, you know, like the Young British Artists kind of movement or whatever, that his work is seen as marketable and that he's able to pay those people to make those paintings and stuff like that. He kind of turns up to celebrity parties with, you know, one of those big spinny, what do you call them? You know, like, it's like a big turny wheel that you spin a canvas on it and then you squeeze paint onto it and then it sprays outwards. He goes to celebrity parties in like London and LA and whatever, turns up with that, in like, and just does it in their house, and then all of these people are drinking champagne and clapping and whatever while he makes his paintings. It's like, you know, like turning up to a kid's party with like balloon animals or whatever. It's that kind of
fun. Yeah, it's like Krusty the Clown in the art world.
Yeah. But it's just, that is not a, you know, like, it's such a bizarre phenomenon to, like, basically those kind of, you know, the people that would be willing to pay for him to make art in that way, you know, they have to see value in his identity as a white male author of artworks or whatever, you know, that, and they're paying into that as an investment or part of their social status. You know, that the majority of people, it doesn't even take skill. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's paid someone with a van to bring a big spinny thing and he just stands at the side squeezing paint. Do you know what I mean? The skill is in, like, the kind of bullshit around that, I suppose, to market.
Exactly. I mean, but, yeah. And that's kind of what Warhol was playing with conceptually and,
yeah,
you know, theoretically, but also practically, and his obsession with money. Like, his diaries are all about money. His money, his spending money, what he made. It's really an obsession.
Yeah, but he came from a very, very poor background as well. So you understand that he came from, like, he was an illustrator and things like that, and made any money he could by selling his illustrations to magazines and stuff like that, and then went on to become what he became, kind of thing. So you understand why he would follow that, and you can understand why other people would follow that as a path, kind of thing. I was going to say, is a flip side, you know, Jeremy Deller, who we watched his film before, he's from a privileged background, but he didn't study art. He spent a year with Andy Warhol, weirdly, and that's how he became an artist. It's like but then his work is all about social commentary, and seeing as he's a very privileged person, like, as far as I understand, he's from a privileged background, kind of went to private school and stuff like that, that his willingness to have deep empathy and build works with people and wanting to represent kind of moments of history, or, you know, like, it's a completely flip side of, I suppose, if you're going to look at the impact of Warhol. Those are two exact
That's a good point. I mean, him spending all that time on, you know, the miner strike and framing that, making that central almost to his entire career, does say something. Absolutely. No, that's cool. What about, I wonder how you feel about this, because there's the idea, I think, that holding many of the essays together, but correct me if I'm wrong, because I only read this one, was this idea of unlearning. And the idea that we have, you know, basically learned, or as a society begun to kind of, I think, internalize is the better word that goes with that Foucauldian idea that comes up again in the essay, is internalized the idea that we need to own our education. We need to pay for our education in order to remain, you know, viable in the workforce. And short of that, you know, it's on us. You know, like, basically the move of neoliberalism and deregulation, as she lays it out, is to return all responsibility away from the government and away from the institutions and on to the individual, in particular the responsibility of cost and pay, you know what I mean, and loans and credit and the implications of that, which we're seeing, you know, globally right now, the implications of the countries who bought into that most and what it looks like for their social fabric. That's a really big question. So I felt like this essay was really relevant. But the thing I struggle with, kind of like Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, right? You can set up the gigantic moral conundrum of this thing, of this moment, of this term, of our political situation, but the ideas for unlearning it, the ideas for kind of resisting it, seem, you know, almost, how do I say it, right? They seem underwhelming. Does that make sense? Am I talking out of school here?
No, I think you're right. I think, when you're faced with the realities of a global neoliberal, in some ways technocratic system or whatever, and then it's like, so at the end of the essay, there's a couple of different headers about so who's excluded from the self, so kind of trying to understand, you know, in you know, in racialized or gendered experience, who's seen as fully human, so who's seen as being able to fully realize themselves, kind of thing, in terms of education or otherwise. Another heading, no culture without social rights and recognition of reproductive labor. So again, kind of, I like it as a slogan kind of thing. But yeah, so it says questions on self-determination, autonomy and freedom, as well as demands for equality, solidarity, recognition of reproductive labor and social rights have been crucial to the modern colonial project. However, as part of the rhetoric of modernity, their separation has inscribed itself in how institutions are organized and how education and learning is conceptualized. The critical pedagogues of the 1970s and 1980s did not accept this separation. It is here that paths of other legacies of cultural practices are reopened and intersect with practices of unlearning, namely unlearning separation between coloniality and modernity, and the separation between artistic and social critique.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you're waiting for something, and it's a good rehash of what came before it. And it's this kind of strange moment where these educational critical pedagogues, right, the Holy Trinity of Illich, Freire, and Hooks, represent an alternative that was somewhat co-opted. And there's no clear sense, like the reading of them even is somewhat like, sometimes I don't know where she stands on critical pedagogy as it's described here, right? Like there's this self, the sense of self and self-determination that if you come from the Frankfurt School and you think through all these different ways in which, you know, culture creates self, and self is a kind of, you know, a manufactured experience sold, it lays bare, you know, what does self-determination look like authentically, you know?
Yeah.
And then why self versus collective? I guess there are bigger questions that I don't think she's trying to solve them all. But when I was getting through in a critique of lifelong learning, she was like, bam, 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 right? And I was like, woo, 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 bring me home. And then I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to find my way back.
It says at the end that this text is part of a forthcoming book. So she's clearly still trying to, so I think she's trying to set out three different ways. So the third one is practicing collectivity otherwise, kind of thing. It's like you're saying, trying to find collective forms of working that don't fit into this model, kind of thing, and kind of criticizing, you know, like thinking critically on the terms of self, kind of thing.
But that brings up a good utopian turn, though, for us. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. I was going to think about where I go next with that thought, but...
Well,
go for it.
It's interesting because it brings up a question of a utopian term, right? One of the things I've always been, well, always, I ever since I heard about some of those hippie colleges in the 60s and 70s and even in the 50s, at least in the U.S., there was one, it was called Blue Mountain College. And the idea was they set it up this campus in the Asheville, these kind of beautiful North Carolina countryside. And people would go there. There would be scholars that stayed there. You'd go there. You learn for as long as you wanted to. You'd have certain things taken care of. There were certain rules about what you could do when you were there. But you didn't have to go to class. You went there to read and then to talk and think through things. And people like John Cage and very famous writers, poets, etc., were part of that movement. And it had about 10, 20-year life. And then it dissipated and it became a kind of like idea of itself bigger than what the thing was probably. But I wonder when we talk about like alternatives to higher ed and we look at the whole, like I saw a really funny meme on Twitter. I think Brian Alexander put it out. It was called like streaming services, you know, Netflix $15.99, Hulu $9.99, Harvard $55,000.
Yeah, someone sent me that as well, yeah.
Which, while yeah. I don't agree with it per se in that really simplistic frame, I do think when you talk about the financial implications of tuition, and back to what Tressie said about thinking of the student as consumer now, and that we're buying a good, and that good is packaged in a certain way, and if that packaging is streaming video for online MOOC course experiences, it does raise questions. And I think those questions have more to do with how we package education than what it means to be a collective experience of education in a distributed network like the web, right? And so what does a co-op of learning look like in a post, you know, in a post kind of COVID era, when it's just, we see the moves being made, and I'm speaking to US, I'm not speaking broadly to Europe or Canada or other places, but you're seeing the moves being made in the US right now. A lot of it very much within Krauss's critique of this lifelong learning idea, basically, you know, the deregulation, the escalation of costs, the buying a product, the learning of a skill, the employability of a generation. Well, I'm not seeing or hearing too many people within these institutions or with these skills saying, well, we can take them outside of that context, like the artists you're talking about, you know, because all of those artists, just like, you know, the big ones, they have to work within a multi-million dollar industry to survive. Yeah. And the alternative is a collective, right? Is some sort of co-op schooling where you build a kind of, what I always felt like the early blogosphere was, you build a coalition of folks writing, sharing, thinking together, and their expertise is demonstrated through the broad collective of discussion. That doesn't happen on Twitter. That doesn't really happen on Facebook. These are the tools of absolute, like, meme-driven, like, $54,000 versus $19.99 for Netflix. The fact that I see that, and that's where my mentality is, versus sitting here with you on the radio discussing cool, important things, suggests that these platforms have hijacked our brains. They have made us dumb. I mean, not me.
Yeah.
Because I'm a genius.
I don't know if this is a weird... when was it this week? My brain is all over the place. A little bit of hope, I went back and read... which, I don't know, it sounds weird. I went and read Walter Benjamin's... the concept of history or whatever, because it's like, I don't know, it came about in a conversation recently. I ended up thinking, oh, I'll just go back to it or whatever. But within there, like, I think, so I want to write about this at some point, kind of connect it more clearly, but I'll say, you were talking about before, like, people can't conceptualize a time before the feed and things like that, and you've kind of said about the feed being an issue before, kind of thing. And I've tried to stay away looking at my Twitter feeds. I rely a lot on, I still go to Twitter because that's, I don't use Instagram or Facebook or whatever else, kind of thing. And there is interesting stuff there, but relying on the feed, even if you follow people that you're interested in, it's kind of feels overwhelming. You're constantly losing context, kind of thing. Your perception of time and the relevancy of things, it gets warped, kind of thing. If you see something multiple times in a day because people are sharing it, then it gains more relevancy, but actually isn't. Like, if it's a kind of that meme that you're talking about before, it feels like, oh, well, that's how everyone's articulating this, so somehow I should be paying attention to that, or it just kind of subconsciously kind of becomes part of the vocabulary that you use to describe things, and then it kind of eats away at your brain space to think about how you'd want to articulate it for yourself, kind of thing. So the way I've been using Twitter, like, so today I've been using TweetDeck or whatever, but quite often I rely on other people DMing me bits of information, and then I'll go to individuals like journalists or whoever else that I like, and then I'll also DM the same people, bits that I think, oh, they're like that. And it's almost like a support network of surviving Twitter, but kind of still having to be on it or whatever. I don't know how to put it. But going back to Walter Benjamin's on the concept of history. So it's talking about how we kind of, I'm not going to assume people have read it or whatever, and if, even if they have or have heard of it or whatever, I'm just going to give my perspective on how I see it relates to this.
That's nice of you, just so you know.
Assuming people have...
I'm serious. It's nice of you because I would just assume. It's smart.
Yeah, well, other people say things and, like, I constantly feel... I feel like it's... I know for some people it isn't a part... They don't see it as a deliberate power move, but I'm not... I don't have any postgraduate education kind of thing. I'm even my undergrads, like I self-taught myself loads of stuff kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, bring people up with you. Don't assume other people know the same stuff as you.
It's going to be, it's going to be the theme of our co-op university, Lauren. We're on to something here.
We'll all DM each other the best of Twitter so we don't have to wade through the crap. And then we'll all explain the terminology we're using so we have a shared vocabulary, but also we can extend our vocabulary. Anyway. But yeah, so in other concepts of history or whatever, him talking about time and like empty time and mesenaic time, is that how you say it? I think, and like empty time being... the time of like dates and calendars and stuff like that. And he relates technocratic or social democratic and social democratic ideas of progress. I'm mixing up. I've had a like, my brain's not working. Oh man, right. Let me start again.
Dustbin of history.
Huh?
Dustbin of history.
Dustbin of history, there you go.
Doesn't he say that at some point, one of his essays? Dustbin of history. Anyway, yeah,
he critiques modernization and progress as ignoring the unreading notes that I sent someone else because I was trying to explain why something related to them. Who critiques modernization and progress as ignoring the impact of produced commodities on workers. And that products and technical developments encourage workers to feel that they are moving with a tide of progress and encourage conformity. And then he compares progressivist and Marxist theories of history with progressivism listing dates, and the latter constructs time from a structure and talks about empty time and mesenaic time. And that social democracy relies on a conformity that is brought about by technocratic thinking and the perception that technical development is progress, and ignores societal impacts and regression for these economic ideas of progress. And then he explains mechanisms of time, space and history in encouraging this continued conformity and what is necessary for emancipatory events that fight for redemption and resurrection, which he talks about with mesenaic time. So with that, I think with the pipeline idea of lifelong learning that you push people through an education system where they constantly feel responsible for their own education and their upskilling to become employable. And also the Annette Krauss thing, she has an interesting point about transitioning from some employment to the concept of employability as well, which is interesting as well. But like the idea of that, but also the idea of feeds and things like that online, it's that empty time idea that we're not, people discuss things and they feel like they're part of something because they're seeing it happening through feeds, but actually it's again that just list of dates and you know, calendars kind of thing. It's that empty time, it's not that moment of something else happening kind of thing. Whereas if you can find ways to break people out of the feeds or out of that system of people being pipelined through, that we might be able to create something else kind of thing. So it's kind of trying to think of how your attention or how your time is being used now, or how people are pushed through a system. And then like, if we're talking about cooperative ways of working or alternative ways of working, maybe it doesn't matter if something only lasts for 20 years. 20 years is a long time. That's a lot of students that you could potentially push through that could have a legacy. And if those are people that then carry on new ideas or whatever, it's that kind of like, let's have a little snap moment that we can radicalize people or give people emancipation in some form. I mean, and then they can exist outside of the system and fight for something else.
That's brilliant. It's brilliant not only because the quote you're reading by Benjamin seems like completely like timely in terms of like,
that,
wow,
that's my notes that I was trying to explain. I said in part 11 he says this, and then in part 17 I decided to cut that out.
It's amazing. The other thing too, though, on your point, which I really love, is the idea that these can be snap moments. Like, these can be, and I think part of the logic right now of higher ed in America, and I'll focus on the U.S. again because that's what I know, is this idea of existential crisis, survive at all costs. Like, nothing is more important, even human casualties, than us surviving. Versus something that is not owned and not monetized in the same way. And I think of the example in my life as DS-106, is it's a thing that lived for a time and had its implications, and then people went on. They didn't have to own it. They didn't have to feel like they contributed because they wanted to. And there's a bunch of experience like people have like that online that no one recognizes and no one's asking you to pay for. And no one's credentialing you, but yet that experience is unbelievably crucial to your formation. And so much of the argument in defense of the tuition and the cost is not just salaries and experience and all of that, which I understand, but is also the kind of like extracurricular connections, right? The whole other network. And I'm like, oh, so we can't do that any other way? Like, I'm thinking to myself, like, sure, we can't in the shithole of social media we've created as our only alternative. Absolutely, you're right. I wouldn't want to send my kid to that. But I do believe, and I've seen firsthand, alternatives. Utopian in their ideals, limited in their realities, but at the same time, like, there are people who have dreamed up other ways in our immediate past, like not too long ago. So I feel like all this talk is like preservation of the institutions at all costs, and those with money that will survive it easier, they're the ones who can make these grandiose claims, and those who are struggling on the margins, these institutions just have to follow the weather and hope everything works because they're living paycheck to paycheck right now. It's like our economy in the U.S. writ large, right? In institutions. It's like the personal economy is mapped now onto the institutional economy, and it's horrifying.
Yeah. And the part of this, the lifelong learning thing, is it's talking about training people to be adaptable and flexible and take on that responsibility, that if you are made unemployed, that's your fault for not being skilled or whatever, and then you have to weather that kind of thing. And like talking about kind of aspects of creativity and other things that might be seen, you know, as you know, I don't know, taking on whatever kind of other kind of connotation previously, now are more to do with that kind of flexibility and kind of being able to self-manage and stuff like that. They talk about like whether you're able to survive or fail higher education as being whether you'd be able to survive or fail, you know, outside in the kind of the job market and things like that. And it's, yeah.
And it's funny too, speaking of that, because one of the things that I was having lunch today with someone in Trento, and we're kind of like back in the city, we're having lunch without masks unless we're inside, like it's weird, it's kind of like getting back to normal, but you know, this place has been hit hard like everywhere else. And one of the things that came up today at lunch, someone was mentioning that there's going to be a massive national strike in Italy in the next couple of months, like massive, and a strike is to raise taxes to start dealing with the basically, like, rather than finding privatized solutions, there's you know, basically unions all over Italy still, and they're organizing to strike to basically make sure that what we've lost as a country is made up with national funds. And like, think about, on my concern, how far like anything in the U.S. is from any logic around that. Like, I mean, that's part of why it's so bad there. Is there's none. There's none of that. There's no sense of a union.
Yeah, we have similar issues in the UK now. Like, for a long time, the UK, the rhetoric in the, like, right-wing politicians in the UK is often that they want to adopt the kind of almost cultural approaches that the US has to different things, like, so to market forces and things like that, and that to be pervasive throughout the population to kind of accept different things. So, like, that's, we're on a trend towards how America thinks as well, but there is still the legacy, you know, we've talked about four miners strike and stuff like that, there is still a legacy of that, I don't know, it's not necessarily like pro-unions and collectivity, but the idea that there some people in power might be working against like community interests and things like that kind of thing, but that's still, it's kind of being further broken down kind of like day by day, it feels, or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. The idea of people fighting to raise taxes would be really cool, and demanding where those taxes go as well. I think that's part of it.
And it's funny because our region here, Trentino, has a lot to gain and lose by that. Because we're one of the autonoma, because we were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then we came over in World War I to Italy, they have more control over their taxes. Big problem is those regions that don't are feeling it even worse, because we can act like our own little Soviet bloc where a lot of the money paid the taxes is kept internally, whereas a lot of the others, it's federally distributed. So that's part of the battle. And, you know, it's in a lot of places, it's bad. Like, I know we're starting to see, I saw a stat, I don't know if it's true, but it was, I wouldn't be surprised if it were, that one in three families in the U.S. in July have not made house payments. Like, wow. Like, think about that. Think about, like, what we're on the verge of. So here's my idea. Stick with me. You ready?
Yeah.
Utopian you. I'm the provost. And the president.
Why
the janitor.
I can be vice chancellor and
you're the vice chancellor. You're in charge of curriculum, all the readings.
Okay, that's good.
Utopian you. What do you think? What do you think? Are you ready?
Doesn't have to be a university, it could be something else.
No, just that's for the swag. Utopian you. T-shirts, sweatshirts, things for your car so you can brag to the other people in the neighborhood that your kid goes to Utopian U. This is a possibility. I'm an idea guy.
Yeah.
Are you with me? Because there's only two ways to be.
Utopian U is not a good name. I just, you know, what? Really rethink that.
Utopian U? Utopian tendencies? We can say our podcast by the 7th episode led to a university. How many people can say that about their stupid little podcast?
I think everyone.
There will be tuition and fees. Particularly, there'll be a tech fee. And they'll have to use Reclaim Hosting. I'm seeing this. Yeah, exactly.
Reclaim University. That's what you're going to call it.
Reclaim you. Exactly.
Oh, man. I don't know. So some of this as well, like, I think it is like a lot of people are just going along with things because they feel desperate to keep their jobs and whatever kind of right now. And like the...
Which I understand, current, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. And the UK government eventually wants to reduce the amount of... It's weird because, so as well, this essay that we're talking about, it criticises European parties like... New Labour in the UK for kind of pushing lifelong learning as a strategy hard kind of thing. And then the Tories at the moment are kind of want to restrict student numbers in the UK, but it's because they follow, even though a lot of their ideas are neoliberal and stuff, they follow that conservative traditional kind of like, they just want to push for the old tradition of like the idea of an elite kind of thing that only so many people get in, then we need to fight like this idea of education is a meritocracy or whatever kind of thing. So that's funny. Like, it's kind of, to me, it's like, instead of getting, it's quite a clever idea to get as many people as possible to take on loans and to buy into the system and think that you're a person, you've personally failed if you haven't learned enough to keep up with market forces and things like that. And then we might shift to this idea of cutting student numbers and whatever the fallout of that. Obviously there's massive economic implications for both as well, that we've got this massive black hole of people now a minimum wage with however much, you know, tens of thousands, 100,000 worth of debt kind of thing that they'll never pay off kind of thing. And then versus only some people will be able to access higher education.
And higher ed debt is like the biggest debt in the U.S. now, which is insane to think of. But it also, you know, this essay made me also think, what a joke MOOCs are. Like, in my mind, when you think about MOOCs as a policy and as a movement and the way in which, separate them from the ideals in the beginning, which I think were sold out right away. But apart from that, that whole idea that you could use the web as some distributed thing to build these courses, turning into a Stanford-branded, Duke-branded, then ultimately Coursera-branded video experience with a scalable LMS was disgusting. And it actually, like, what she's saying about lifelong learning was exactly the kind of marketing material that these universities were laying out, and they were even worse. They were talking about that kid in the other part of the world, undeveloped, who we saved from the clutches of, you know, poverty. I mean, it's absolutely not, it is a shame to think that there are people still pauding, like, the value of that. Like, I even saw Duke University is going to make a deal with Coursera, who, you know, 6 short years ago got all of those universities' courses for free at the cost of the university, is now selling it back to Duke and all these other schools as if it's some sort of deal. I mean, it is the market logic that she is talking about that has overtaken higher ed, epitomized in the MOOC, epitomized in it in its worst possible fashion. And there are still jackasses out there applauding it. It's like, that's the death of anything interesting. Not only that, but it's a policy, political, financial, like, clusterfuck, right? And I think that Brian Lamb shaming me on Twitter while I'm going on, you know, here, University of Utopia. What the hell is University? I'm talking about Utopian U, not University of Utopia.
Completely different, Brandon.
Exactly. You. So what do you think? Are you in?
You've now established this idea that I've now got to buy into.
Yeah.
I'll do my own thing. You do. We'll compete against each other.
We'll be competing in universities. Although I do have to say, it gave me an excuse to, when I see people applauding the MOOCs, they haven't gone anywhere, they're still here. It's like,
it's like the whole MOOC thing as well. I don't. Things like that as a, I don't know, like, I don't know how to put it, as like a newer person to edtech stuff or higher ed or whatever else, it doesn't make sense to me. So it's like, I don't get the kind of evangelical rhetoric, or I don't feel like I have a way in, like I don't understand the cultural
good
moment that it existed in. So it's just, it's one of those, it's like an ephemera that kind of continues to exist, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I just can only ask why. I don't know.
It's completely denatured from anything it was supposed to be, like, you know, learning networks of feeds that we were talking about in relationship to, like, Benjamin, and, like, this kind of more advanced distributed network thing became, you know, a branded, you know, white-labeled university, usually very wealthy, high-end U.S. university that the world just piled on. And I think the world piled on, and it's easy to see why the world piled on when you see the history of lifelong learning through this essay. it's understandable why Europe jumped in, right? Because, you know, Europe's no better in some ways than the way in which the rest of the world, in particular the U.S., is framing it. Like, luckily, though, they still have vestiges of a social system, right? Yeah. But it's the same logic. You know, that's why when Europeans get high and mighty, I feel like saying, simmer the fuck down.
the Brexit thing, like, there was this contingent that people talked about, this idea of Lexit, like, that there's, like, left, social ideas of why you wouldn't want the European Union to exist or why it needs to be reformed. And there's a lot of arguments for why it needs to be reformed. And it's mainly around that it pushes this idea of marketization of everything through soft politics. I think it makes all the different states buy into this idea, and then Italy, Greece, whoever else who wasn't able to kind of deal with the 2008 crash and wouldn't kind of adhere to whatever kind of loan strategies and stuff like that. Well, you're not kind of adhering to the rules of the market here by how we see it. Therefore, you're allowed to fail and your people aren't able to access healthcare, just basic things, food, whatever. You keep freezing. I don't know if you're there or not, or whatever.
But I am here.
So people within Europe see the European Union, or I don't know, it's different contingent parts don't. It's not the most ideal way, shall we put it? Of different union states working together, kind of thing. But the rhetoric and the forces behind Brexit are wholly neoliberal to, like, you know, like we've briefly talked about, like, the disaster capitalism element behind it, like people that were backing Brexit betting on the UK economy completely crashing, kind of thing, and different companies going under. It's just a bizarre.
I tell you, this, your whole discussion right now reminds me of conversations I had in 2015 when I was in Barcelona. I remember Martin Weller saying to me, like, yeah, but OER, it's not the same thing in Europe, or particularly Britain, because, like, we don't really have expensive textbooks, right? And so, like, that whole idea that the OER would be something different. And I would argue that this essay for lifelong learning, this critique, which is really a Foucauldian critique, is very much, you could do the same thing for OER. Like, OER can be, and open in general, can be absolutely gutted. And even, like, you know, up and until 2019 OER conference, you know, the Open Ed conference, like, you could gut that whole movement, which I was, you know, in some ways connected with, around the whole logic of way in which open was used as a way to drive all these market forces to create the market, right? And to use it as a way to frame open as, like we said, a necessarily moral upstanding good, only to build a market around it and gut out anything that was potentially political or arguably equitable. So it's, and to see that to come Europe when in 2015, and I saw it coming earlier, but I was like, really? You really need this? Like, this is, like, horrible. This is killing ed tech in the U.S., and it was already kind of run its course. And seeing it take hold in Europe, for me, was depressing. And then going to conferences here in Italy where they were talking about OER and they were talking about MOOCs. And I'm writing a foreword to an Italian book right now. And I'm struggling because it's about OER. And I'm now reading this essay thinking, like, do I go there? Like, do I, like, open up a little bit of critique without being offensive, because I think the person's defending them? I don't know. You know what? I found myself in a bit of a pickle thanks to your reading this week.
Yeah. That's me every day, though. Like, I'm just constantly cynical about everything and screaming why and everything. But, you know, welcome to my world.
I want to, you know, I think we do probably have to wrap this up, but I do want to thank a few of our listeners. How do you feel about that? Interactive radio. This is how we get people to join our institution.
Yeah, I haven't been checking feed. I thought you said they don't exist.
They don't exist. I don't think they're really reading. I don't think they're really listening. I think they just want to shout on the radio. They're not listening. Although I do think Anne-Marie is listening. Because she is actually quoting you. We'll compete against each other. Market forces for the win. So she says that. She also says, I spent some time yesterday in a conversation about how, at the time, universities were busy frothing over MOOCs. An entire B2C training industry ballooned outside higher ed, much of which is now a perceived threat. And I think one of the things that also happened there was, what are they called? I always forget their name. It's like this horrific thing. What are they called? Someone called them like the termites that ate out the core of higher ed in the U.S. I think it was like Kevin Kelly. I forget what they called. IP, EP. Anyway, they're basically design firms like D2L. Like, not D2L, but something like Design to iDesign or whatever. They're like these design instructional technology outsourced programs. USC was famous for them. And while everyone was like, you know, deciding which MOOC brand they were going to buy at the supermarket, these things emerged and like gutted entire universities. I think Concordia University, I think, is declaring bankruptcy. And they were like insane. Someone will remember what they were called. But I do want to thank Anne-Marie, Brian, Shannon, Tanya, all the good folks. Scott Lowe, if he was listening, I don't know, maybe he left us. He's not too into EdTech. He just tolerates it.
Right? He did a good 30 minutes of music.
He's great. I love his music. He makes me happy. But it was fun. What is this, episode 7 of Utopian Tendencies?
I should know.
Me too.
I'm behind blogging, so I don't know. I've lost count.
Yeah.
If we've lost count, that's good, though. That's definitely a series.
Yeah. I agree. It's a series. Yeah, and Anne-Marie liked my last connection for the open movement. And I think it's right. I think that this critique can be done about open education, particularly given like 2019-2020 was a flag in the kind of direction of that movement, and which is a movement I felt part of. And I don't know, even Brian Lamb would say, is it a movement? He says, like, what do you mean? It's not a movement. But I felt like I was an open educator. Like, I was transparent with everything. I tried to invite people in, and I thought the open web was a good thing.
And Marie says, OPMs.
OPMs, yes.
So you all
online
stuff,
just program managers. Management.
I've heard that before.
OPMs. Thank you, Anne-Marie. Thank you for listening. I knew she would bail me out. But OPMs, like while we were sleeping, and we were sleeping in MOOC hell, OPMs came in, at least in the U.S. Again, I'm very U.S.-centric. I apologize for that. But at least there. And even so much so that I only like had a conversation. This is a little behind baseball. So someone calls me up. Person will remain nameless, and they're like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, hey, how you doing? You know, the U.S. thing. Hey, how's it going? Good, how are you? You like that? It's pretty good, like, yeah, as an imitation of an American. So anyway, we went through, hey, good, great, great, how's everything? Good. So anyway, the person just flat out asked me, how much money do you make at Reclaim? I was like, what? No one had ever, like, flat out, like, what's your bottom line? So I was like, why? Right? And she was like, or he was like, well, because we make, like, X million. And I just want to get a sense of where we stand in the big picture. And the number she named, or he named, I was like, what? That was an OPM. And I almost fell off my chair. I left the office because I was in Virginia. I went to Tim. I said, Tim, come here. I'm going to talk to you. The number was so big. And like, I was like, you know, for a second, I was feeling bad. Like, oh, maybe this person wants to, like, you know, like, this point when you're young, like, hey, you show me yours, I'll show you mine. Like, I was like, what? And so anyway, I then started to like look into it, read the Kevin Kelly piece. And this is an insanely lucrative industry with completely like, it's like the mafia. It's like at the point you let the mafia into your business, they gut it and they sell it off for pieces. That's what it's like. How do you like that? Inside baseball. Oh, this is really now I'm getting good.
Inside baseball.
But yeah, I didn't.
Weird flex, just running up to someone and saying, this is how much we make.
Could you imagine that? I mean, I was really shocked. And not that, like, you know, it's like money. I don't know, like, money's crazy, so you got to be careful with it. But, like, when, and I felt like for a second, like, oh, wow, like, we might make a lot compared to this, so I want to be careful. And then she said, like, the number is set, and I'm like, what the hell? I was like, we don't make anything. I was like, we're broke.
Oh, no. The things, yeah, I don't know. Not utopic, but the mafia are in.
No, it's not utopic. But you know what? It's just. We need it. We need a little utopia in our day.
Did we get any from this? I don't know.
I got some.
I didn't know if I'd even be able to talk today or my brain would function at all today.
You were awesome. I tell you, the Walter Benjamin stuff was awesome. We're still on the radio, just so you don't, so you know.
Thank you.
But yeah, the Walter Benjamin stuff was amazing. Did you think we were off?
No, I didn't. Okay. I liked your clarification.
No, because I felt bad. I still feel guilty.
You shouldn't feel, yeah. It was just my brain completely zapped out. I was just like, not alone. I was like, yeah.
No, that's great, though. I have to go and read that. It was really, and you know what? I'll be honest. I'm realizing with this, and like with everything I do, there's nothing I do that's polished. My blog sucks. My videos suck. Like, luckily, Tim and Lauren make Reclaim good, but nothing I do is polished. But returning to something where I'm thinking and reading is like, I'll be honest with you, it's super nice. And I mean, it's hard. Just, you know, everyone has their own reasons why they don't do whatever. But, like, I'm enjoying it. I'm getting a lot out of it, personally. And I think that's why you do anything. You know, the hordes will never come. So it's just about doing the work, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm only chatting because it's nice to talk through this kind of stuff, kind of thing. And, yeah. Like, I don't know. Well, it literally came about because you were just like, yeah, let's talk about this on the radio, because you just, yeah. Like, people decided to start.
Because you were the only one who's uninformed enough about my history that you would get on the radio.
That's fine.
But now, you know, the cat's out of the bag.
And I'm still here.
That's so. Right. So let's plan on something for next week. If you're up to it, send me an essay. I'm locked in.
Maybe not next week, the week after maybe.
Perfect. Yeah, I think that. I don't go away. I go away July 25th. I'm going away.
What?
On a vacation. We can actually vacay here in Italy now, within Italy.
That's cool. Have a house I can go to in the Peak District, but there's lots of hills. So I'm hoping maybe next week for a little bit, I'll hide. There's no Wi-Fi where I'm going, so
that's good. Walking. Well, you bring some books. I think that's what I'm going to do at the beach. That's where I'm going. I'm going to the beach. I'm going to bring a good couple of books. And
all the beaches in the UK are just like disease hotspots because like our government doesn't care if people die. They just want people to work and prop up the economy. So everyone keeps going to different beaches in the UK and just sneezing on each other and whatever else, and then people die. Yeah, it's great. So I'm going to be going to the beach.
Yeah. I'm going to Sardinia, so hopefully, but like there, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, right now we haven't had our virus, at least of right now, is very much under control. Like, we're not New Zealand yet, but we're in pretty good shape overall. So we'll see. I don't know. I mean, It depends. I think even different people in my family feel differently about doing it. But Aunt and Elle and I were like, you know what? We're going to try. Because we've been in the house for like, I mean, pretty much 4 months now. Since end of February.
Yeah. I mean, it's just about being careful, isn't it? Kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're gonna fly though. So if you know what, if I don't make it, remember me.
Okay.
This podcast must go on. Utopian thinking. Utopian tendency. All right.
Well, enjoy yourself.
I will. It's almost 8 o'clock here, so I'm going to call out. But hey, thanks for making the time to do this. I did want to get one in, and I love the reading, and I look forward to the next one.
Cool. Okay.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. DS106 Radio. This has been Utopian Tendencies. I believe it's episode 7, but I'll confirm that here shortly. And we are over and out. Yeah. Yeah.